The last time we may recall, we spoke generally of the condition of the world. The extension of knowledge and possibly a diminution of wisdom has brought humanity to a grave crisis point. I think I need not go into it again. We don't have the time anyhow. And we said, we are threatened by various dangers, war, or even minor conflicts, the destruction of the environment, the increasing population, and so on. Most people are not aware of the seriousness of the situation, still less aware that we are faced with such critical challenges because of what we ourselves have been doing, or more accurately, because of the way in which our minds work. Petty, personal, nationalistic, greedy, indifferent to others, violent, selfish, envious if others have more, and so on and so forth. And it's very important to see that the outer conditions, the pollution, the stresses of life, the ever-spreading violence, it's all a reflection of what goes on inside the human mind. Your mind, my mind, everybody's mind, in a lesser or greater degree. And we cannot dismiss it, dismiss the question, because we feel that within one's own mind, it doesn't take serious proportions. Because we said, when there is a seed, it can become a great weed. We also mentioned that because the world has changed outwardly and become closely knit together, there is no solution for any important problem which can be the solution for one people, one group. It has to be a global solution. Everything that we think of by way of progress, improvement, must be for all of humanity. There cannot be a solution to the problem of pollution for one nation. It has to be for everybody. We also said that we have been thinking too long in terms of immediate solutions, immediate advantages, and this short-sighted view has resulted always in a kind of patching up and not in a renewal. And so the character of society, human society, has not basically changed. People have always been fighting, fighting. We continue to do it with better weapons, immensely better weapons. We've always been possessive, wanting to acquire land, territory, other people's countries, their resources, etc. We continue to do that. We've always been retaliating. If they fire rockets, let's have better ones to fire at them. If they fight, we fight. And so on. So, the world goes on in the same way, basically adopting perhaps somewhat different methods to act in the same way. So there has to be a radical change. And that change cannot come about in society as such. It has to come in the mind, because everything begins with the mind. War, everything. From within outwards. So the mind has to change, and the main work of the society, of the theosophical society, is to put this, to be clear about this, the members must be clear about this, and communicate this as far as possible. It's so important. And the mind must change not by little steps, because there may not be the time left for it, for one thing. And little steps don't help. If you are less selfish, it isn't enough. We tend to make ourselves comfortable by stopping after taking a few steps. Because when there are some embers smoldering, they can flame up and burn the whole house. And there is no such thing, perhaps, as being a little pure. Either one is pure or not. If the water is dirty, it is dirty. Otherwise, it's pure. There is a joke about a woman being a little bit pregnant. You can't do that. So, what we have to work for is a radical change, and that is regeneration. If you don't like the word, use some other word. It is a change from one dimension of consciousness or mind to another dimension. And we said, perhaps not the other morning, but at the question and answer meeting, that one aspect of that change is indicated by the phrase universal brotherhood. There is a radical difference between a mind which is personal. Personal means me, my family, my nation, my people, my religion, and the mind which is universal, for whom all of life is one life. And therefore, there is no my nation. All people are my people. There is a very beautiful Sanskrit verse. I won't bother you with it, but it speaks about the sannyasi. The sannyasi is not someone who puts on a yellow robe. It has been degraded into such a thing. But the sannyasi is one for whom the whole of humanity is the family. All the earth is his home, and so on. This was said 2000 years ago. So that is the universal mind. This is one aspect, facet of this change which has to take place, which is regeneration. Can the mind cease to be personal and become universal? Let us not say, I also love, because I love this person, that person, some people, according to my choice. No, that is still personal. It's better to love a few people than to love none, but that's a different question. But it is personal, selective, partial. But can the mind shift from that to learning to, if not to love, to feel goodwill, to feel a sense of kinship with all people and all creatures? It is said that an enlightened consciousness is one, is like the sun, whose warmth and light are not for any particular people. It's there. And everybody can benefit from it. So the universal mind is one which has no barriers, no compartments. A marvelous change. We don't realize the beauty of the object of the Theosophical Society. If we did, we'd be thrilled by whatever work we do. Then secondly, this renewal of the mind, the new mind, implies, we have also spoken about this, a change from a state of bondage. I don't like using that word, which has been much used in philosophy, to a state of freedom. Nobody else is putting fetters on us. But by allowing our minds to get imprinted by other people's thoughts, by tendencies which we have collected, by letting ourselves become creatures of habit, the habit of looking on anybody who is different from us as an alien, the habit of getting irritated whenever we are a bit crossed, and so on and so forth. So by habit, we think, act, react, relate ourselves. And habit is compulsion. Habit, automatism, means absence of freedom. Acting according to a pattern means we are programmed like machines. So we go according to the program. Where is the freedom in that? So the new dimension of the mind means absolute freedom, which has been the goal of many people theoretically, if not in practice. Freedom from all those inner compulsions, the programming which comes from our past and from the continual conditioning we might undergo if we are not intelligent and aware even in the present. So this dimensional change means transcending the personal, experiencing the universal, not being anymore under any kind of compulsion, but having an inward sense of freedom. It is also a change from self-centeredness to altruism. Being personal and being self-centered is similar, but there is a little difference. It is a change from a state of ignorance to one of wisdom. We may not believe we are totally ignorant, but perhaps we are, because the knowledge we possess doesn't seem to aid us to experience what all of us want, that is, a profound sense of happiness, of well-being, of peace and harmony. We all want that, but what we know doesn't help us. If for a time we are all right, we get easily disturbed. That girl was singing about that yesterday. And so we haven't found out how to have an inner stability, an inner wellspring of peace, happiness, fulfillment. And as long as we don't know how, we are in a state of ignorance. We don't know what is the, is if there is a possibility of being free of suffering. We don't know what is life's significance. We don't even know how to relate ourselves to our neighbor. But we think we know so many things. We will go into this later. So we don't know what is essential for life. We know a lot of unessential things. And we fall into the illusion that we know, we are learning. That is why the ancient people spoke about two kinds of knowledge, the lesser knowledge and the greater knowledge. The lesser knowledge is the ordinary knowledge, even the knowledge of the man who is an expert in the Bible or the Veda or whatever, the clever philosopher, the brilliant scientist, they all possess only the lesser knowledge. Because these brilliant people may not know how to get on with a son or how to deal with an ordinary problem in life, or even how to die. The greater knowledge is the knowledge which frees one, delivers one from ignorance, the kind of ignorance we spoke about. And that knowledge is of value in coming to that state of mind which is freedom from ignorance and therefore wisdom. So the change which we are talking about is a change from a state of ignorance, which one of the Upanishads says knowledge is worse than ignorance, in the sense that at least if we know we are ignorant, we are beginning to be a little wise. But when we think we have got knowledge, because we have got the lesser knowledge, then we are in a hole. Anyhow, it is a change from the state of ignorance to a state of clarity, wisdom. And self-centeredness, selfishness, is the essence of ignorance. We believe that we can go on with it. We don't realize that it is leading us to all kinds of problems. In fact, practically every problem we face is created by our own selfish mind. This may seem like a drastic statement, but I believe in it absolutely. That which doesn't mean anything, you need not believe in it, but I'm putting it forward, something to be considered, that as long as the mind is obscured, not only obscured but agitated, put in a turmoil by its self-seeking, self-consciousness. I used it as being different from self-awareness. The feeling, I am separate, I am other, which may exist even when one is not going out to get something for oneself. One may sit in a prison cell and be full of this selfhood. As long as there is that, one is in a prison cell. It's a form of imprisonment. But it creates turbulence, obscurity. So it's of the essence of ignorance. Let's look at it a little bit. Because when it is there, we can never see anything in a clear light as it is. When we look at a flower, say, I like the flower. Whether I like it or not has no relevance at all. The flower is there in all its beauty. If I really responded to it, that response would be silent. That means without the eye pushing itself forward. But this is our common way. All of us are like that. We think of everything in terms of I. What I like, what I spoke, what I heard, what I want to say, what dress I like to wear. Please listen to ordinary conversation. See how, not X, Y, or Z, how the human mind is possessed by this I notion. So it becomes extraordinarily boring if you begin to listen to it and you hear it all the time. All I ate something, so I liked it, and I tell everybody, oh, I ate that this morning. And because I am so full of it myself. The other person may not be at all interested in what I ate this morning. Is it a very interesting thing? Perhaps not. But the eye is there, and we see everything through that. The Buddhists say there is no nirvana somewhere. Both samsara, that means bondage, the cycle of necessity, the compulsion which takes you round and round in a circle of suffering. That samsara and that liberation, which is a state of blessedness, nirvana, both are here. When you see life through the egotistic mind, it is samsara. When you see with clear eyes, to use the Buddha's words, through dustless eyes, there is nirvana. So, ignorance takes many forms. Its essence is selfhood. And regeneration is freedom from that ignorance and that I-ness to a state of clarity, wisdom, and love, altruism. For where, as long as this I is operating, there cannot be love, real love. That profound sense of altruism, which is theosophy, we must have heard, or we should have heard, the phrase theosophy is altruism first and last. There is so much in this change. I won't go on too long with that. But we'll think of one more thing. That is, it is a step out of our normal turmoil, state of conscious or unconscious suffering, to one of profound peace. Because we carry a burden with us all the time. The burden of unfulfilled desires, of loneliness, of not quite understanding why we are here, what we are to do, and therefore trying to escape it by distraction, by chattering, by shopping, by fighting, by so many things. So this is life. Internal agitation, restlessness, conflict, hope, clutching at something, disappointment, all this goes on. So, all that is left behind to find a peace which nothing can disturb. So, to resume what we have said, regeneration means all this. A mind which is moving, journeying from the personal to the universal, from ignorance to wisdom, clarity, from selfishness to love, from agitation, turmoil to peace, from suffering to bliss. It means all that. And it's possible. People have experienced it. Perhaps in our better moments, we have all had a little foretaste of it. We have. The word peace wouldn't mean a thing to somebody who has never experienced something of peace, some moment. Is it not? It may be very imperfect, very momentary, yet we've tasted something, and that's why if somebody uses the word peace, we can know what he is talking about. So, what humanity is capable of coming to this, and this is the destiny of humanity. If we want to put it in technical terms, we can say humanity has to go beyond the personal lower mind to a new awareness. These technical terms are rather difficult to use, because as soon as we have used the technical term, we feel we know. We don't go into what it means, or we engage ourselves in purely academic discussions. And that is no good. Now we come to something else. Then, if a renewal, a radical change in the mind is what is necessary for all of us, all of us means all people everywhere, including ourselves who are present here. If this is what we need, and if this is the work of the Theosophical Society, the basic central work of the society, then what should we do in the society? How do we go about it? We can't set up a guru. That's the last thing we wanted. Because gurus have existed and the world goes on in the same way. People have been near very, very highly evolved persons and done terrible things. Judas and Devadatta, and there are, symbolic figures in every religion. It's just to warn us that getting to Tibet or sitting near somebody we think is a glorious god is not going to do anything. And I think this is one of the important things in theosophy. Our theosophical approach must be one which makes clear that every person has to do something himself. This is not another form of selfishness or self-centeredness. But, you know, there are religions, religious schools, which are propagating this false doctrine. I say it without any hesitation. The false doctrine that somebody from somewhere else can do the work for you and send you to a superconscious world. So all that you have to do is to flatter him by sitting next to him and listening attentively to him. This is our idea of God also. Perhaps Krishnamurti was right when he said, the gurus destroy the disciples and the disciples destroy the gurus. There's much truth in it. It's not a, because when we are asking, I mean we, large numbers of people, for somebody who will proclaim, who will declare that all that they have to do is to attend on him, flatter him, give him presents, pass on money to him, and sort of worship him. That will naturally, we create those types of people, we encourage that kind of thing. But the theosophical approach completely repudiates it. It's not I who am saying it. But that is the whole approach. The society was partly founded in order to free people of psychological enslavement. Please read the Mahatma letters. And we mustn't give encouragement to enslavement of any kind, tyranny over the minds of others. The only great teachers are teachers who say, consider what I say, don't believe what I say, don't repeat what I say blindly. Consider, go into it, which doesn't mean reject it immediately. So, I think our theosophical approach to all questions must be one of a person who is seeking the truth and who realizes that the truth is within oneself. This is a difficult thing for many people to realize. The truth is within oneself, which means it is, truth is a state of consciousness. When the consciousness, now the importance of all we said till now, when the consciousness is clear, pure, which means not selfish, clouded by selfishness, when it is clear, when it is pure, when it is universal, when it is sensitive, when it is subtle, when the consciousness has a certain quality, we may then say it's a spiritual quality, then it sees the truth instantaneously. It knows where the shadows are and doesn't mistake the shadows for light. HPB gave a beautiful illustration. You may have read it, heard it, but it's worth considering it. Imagine a wonderful picture. a masterpiece of art. A savage mind is looking at it, an undeveloped, dull mind. Doesn't see anything there, seems like some odd patches of color thrown on that piece of canvas. And why is it hanging on the wall? He can't understand. If that consciousness were to cultivate itself, become more perceptive, it will begin to see that the colors and the lines there make a design. There is a picture. This is not just imagination, it's a fact. An undeveloped mind doesn't see much in a picture because it doesn't see a picture. It doesn't see the relationship of everything which is there to each other. But when it develops, it sees the picture. If it were to become more sensitive, more refined, then it sees beauty in the picture. How often it happens that there is beauty in a piece of music, in an art, in a person's face, in nature, and there are minds which don't see the beauty, which don't respond to it, because the mind is not in that condition. The beauty is there, but the mind doesn't see. And it is something like that. Truth is everywhere, but all life is truth, because life is the only thing that is. Life as it is, not life as we think it is, as we perceive it with our senses, as we interpret it, but life as it is, which may be something vast, mysterious, profound, full of music, the music of the spheres. But we don't see it. We see a sort of a reflection or shadow of a crust. And if we are to see it, our consciousness has to become sensitive, clear and pure and subtle, profound. So the guru may be sitting there. Some text may be saying some wonderful things. But to the consciousness which is not developed, gets nothing from it. Therefore, the one thing to do is for each person to work and bring the truth out from himself. Within you is the light of the world. The light on the path says. That's a fact. It's a logical thing. We needn't just accept that statement. It's a logical thing. There's a wonderful piece of Western music, let us say. An Indian who has never heard Western music hears the sounds, but doesn't hear the music, doesn't convey anything to him. But if he continues to listen, he may begin to hear the music. What is the difference between the sound and the music? It is in consciousness, nothing else. The consciousness which becomes aware of the harmony, the beauty of the melody, etc., begins to hear the music. When it's not able to do that, it hears sounds. We see forms, but we don't know life. We don't know the significance of life. And there may be immense depths which we have to learn to plumb. So, I think one thing which is important from our theosophical point of view with regard to this subject of transformation in whatever we work we do, we must encourage this. I don't know how to put it. I was going to say self-effort. But I suppose you will understand it. It's a self-effort which has to abolish the self or selfhood. But not wait upon an agency outside, some god, some guru, some HPB or anybody. That's sense of responsibility, the willingness to tread the path for oneself, that we must encourage that. And if we know something more, we have to modify the postulate or throw it out into the dustbin, we must be prepared to do that. There can be a reasonable postulate. Reincarnation, as far as we are concerned, may be a reasonable postulate. I don't suppose anybody here can say, I know it as a fact. Now, we must be very careful when we think we know something as a fact, because it may be just imagination. There are all kinds of possibilities of self-deception. So one must hold one's own dreams and, visions rather lightly, question them. Which doesn't mean becoming cynical, materialistic, not at all. But it means being alert and not fall into traps, psychological traps. So our attitude must be one of seeking the truth. And the whole of the society, I believe, is meant for that. HPB in the early days spoke about an attitude of free and fearless investigation. Not merely into obvious things. We can investigate whether the biographical data about a particular person are correct or not. That's relatively easy. But to explore whether what we understand now is truth, whether what somebody says is truth, not taking words and concepts for truth, this is an arduous task. For words are not truth. We can say, love thy neighbor as yourself, because Jesus said it. But it is not truth. As long as we don't actually love, we know the truth of that word, love, only when it is ourselves. Talking about happiness is not to know the truth of happiness. So, truth is something else, something which is known as an incontrovertible reality in the depth of one's heart, not held as a notion, not a dream, imagination. And so, to find the truth, and we said truth means to see, know life as it is, in all its depth and glory. One must remain a learner. It is the learner, HPB's golden stairs. the learner may climb to the temple of divine wisdom, not the person who knows. So can we communicate with our fellow members, with the public, encouraging an attitude of non-dependence, not expecting wonderful things to come from outside. I am talking about not material things, of course. A spirit of non-dependence, an attitude of inquiry, an earnest quest for truth, an attitude of altruism, of cooperation, of harmony. There is nothing more disastrous in the theosophical society than dissension, fighting, slandering, and so on. In the early days, HPB used to cancel people's diplomas for slander. We don't do that anymore. Backbiting. Because the truth of life is unity. It is some dimly somewhere, I suppose we are aware of it, and that's why we have subscribed to the object. That all life is one, not put together and made one. HPB gave this example. She said, keep in the background of the mind, you find it in Commander Bowen's notes, certain important things. One is that there is only one being, not like many soldiers brought from different places and amassed together in an army. You can break them up and send them home. No. But something which is an integral whole. No outside and inside and all that. A whole. Life is that. So if that is the truth of life, that's one aspect, I believe, of life, then if we are in discord, feeling separate, etc., we are not proceeding towards the truth. The Theosophical Society accepts almost as a presupposition that we work on the basis of the unity, the truth of unity. And it's very important in our work to maintain this spirit of friendship, of cooperation, helpfulness, understanding. Dr. Besant said a marvelous thing when she pointed out that when the mind goes on seeing what is wrong with another person, it is because that mind is so stupid. She didn't say stupid, I am translating. It is unable to see the good, which is the real person, and the faults, which are just the outer person, sees only the faults. The fault may not be a fault. So there is something wrong in the vision of the person who sees only the wrong. If we can see a little more of the totality of the person, he is a divine spark like everyone else, trying to flame up, then we see a little better. Anyhow, I believe that in the theosophical work, it is important that we make the approach right. An approach, as we said, seeking for the truth, not belief. A certain seriousness, a spirit of not looking to something outside to bring us the light. A real spirit of brotherhood and a sense of altruism. Aware that whatever we do must bring about something good for all of humanity. We are not working for ourselves, for our little group, not even for the Theosophical Society. The society exists for humanity. We mustn't get lost in something very local, small, not in our hearts. Of course, we can't all go trapezing around the world, and we may not be basically different if we do. One can have a very petty mind and travel all over the world. I don't mean that, but to have an open, a heart open to the world, that is very important. So if we can create a spirit like that, and if we study Theosophy in that sense, study Theosophy in a way which will open the mind, help it to transform itself, not study Theosophy like as a theory, as an intellectual, exercise, which has no relevance to our actual living, our relationship. But study Theosophy so that it brings about transformation. How to do it, we have to find out.